You're just guessing.
Reacher nodded. I was, but I'm not now. Now, I know for sure. I fired a round down in Kentucky. The guy made me, like a rite of passage. I was full of caffeine. I was twitching like crazy. Now I know James Barr will have been way worse.
Why?
Rosemary asked. Because he has Parkinson's disease, Reacher said to her. PA means paralysis agitans, and paralysis agitans is what doctors call Parkinson's disease. Your brother's getting sick, I'm afraid, shaking and twitching, and no way on earth can you fire a rifle accurately with Parkinson's disease. My opinion, not only didn't he do the thing on Friday, he couldn't possibly have done it. Rosemary went quiet. Good news and bad news. She glanced at the window, looked at the floor. She was dressed like a widow. Black silk blouse, black pencil skirt, black nylons, black patent leather shoes with a low heel.
Maybe that's why he was so angry all the time. Maybe he felt it coming on. Felt helpless. Out of control. His body started to let him down. He would have hated that. Anyone would.
Then she looked straight at Reacher.
I told you he was innocent.
Ma'am, I apologize unreservedly. You were right. He reformed. He kept to his bargain. He deserves credit, and I'm sorry he's sick.
Now you've got to help him. You promised.
I am helping him. Since Monday night, I haven't done anything else.
This is crazy.
No, it's exactly the same as it always was. It's someone setting James Barr up for the fall. But instead of actually making him do it, they just made it look like he did it. That's the only practical difference here.
But is it possible?
Anyani asked.
Why not?
Think it through. Walk it through. Anyani walked it through. She rehearsed little movements, slowly, thoughtfully, like an actress.
He dresses in Barr's clothes and shoes, and maybe finds a quarter in a jar or in a pocket somewhere. He wears gloves so as not to mess up Barr's fingerprints. He's already taken the traffic cone from Barr's garage, maybe the day before. He gets the rifle from the basement. It's already been loaded by Barr himself previously. He drives to town in Barr's minivan. He leaves all the clues, covers himself in cement dust, comes back to the house and puts everything away and leaves. Fast, not even taking the time to use the bathroom. Then James Barr comes home sometime later and walks into a trap he doesn't even know is there.
That's exactly how I see it, Reacher said.
But where was Barr at the time?
Helen said.
Out. Well, that's a nice coincidence, Franklin said.
I don't think it was. I think they arranged something to get him out of the way. He remembers going out somewhere, previously, then being optimistic, like something good was about to happen. I think they set him up with someone. I think they engineered a chance meeting that led somewhere. I think he had a date on Friday.
With who?
Sandy, maybe. They turned her loose on me. Maybe they turned her loose on him, too. He dressed well on Friday. The report shows his wallet was in a decent pair of pants.
So who really did it?
Helen asked. Someone cold as ice. Someone who didn't even need to use the bathroom afterward.
Charlie, Rosemary said. Got to be. Has to be. He's small. He's weird. He knew the house. He knew where everything was. The dog knew him.
He was a terrible shooter, too, Reacher said. That's the other reason why I went to Kentucky. I wanted to test that theory.
So who was it?
Charlie, Reacher said. His evidence was faked, too, but in a different way. The holes in his targets were all over the place, except they weren't really all over the place. The distribution wasn't entirely random. He was trying to disguise how good he actually was. He was aiming at arbitrary points on the paper, and he was hitting those points every time, dead on, believe me. Once in a while he would get bored and he'd put one through the inner ring, or he'd pick on a quadrant outside the outer ring and put a round straight through it. One time he drilled all four corners. The point is, it doesn't really matter what you aim at as long as you hit it. It's only convention that makes us aim at the ten ring. It's just as good practice to aim at some other spot, even a spot off the paper, like a tree. That's what Charlie was doing. He was a tremendous shot, training hard, but trying to look like he was missing all the time. But like I said, true randomness is impossible for a human to achieve. There are always patterns.
Why would he do that?
Helen asked. For an alibi?
Making people think he couldn't shoot?
Reacher nodded. He noticed that the rangemaster was saving the used targets. He's an ice-cold pro who thinks about every wrinkle ahead of time.
Who is he? Franklin asked.
His real name is Chenko, and he hangs with a bunch of Russians. He's probably a Red Army veteran, probably one of their snipers, and they're real good. They always have been.
How do we get to him?
Through the victim.
Square one. The victims are all dead ends. You'll have to come up with something better than that.
His boss calls himself the Zek.
What kind of a name is that?
It's a word, not a name. Old-time Soviet slang. A Zek was a labor camp inmate in the Gulag in Siberia. Those camps are ancient history. Which makes the Zek a very old man, but a very tough old man. Probably way tougher than we can imagine. The Zek was tired after his stint with the backhoe, but he was used to being tired. He had been tired for 63 years. He had been tired since the day the recruiter came to his village in the early fall of 1942. His village was 4,000 miles from anywhere, and the recruiter was a type of Moscow Russian nobody had ever seen before. He was brisk and self-assured and confident. He permitted no argument, no discussion. All males between the ages of 16 and 50 were to come with him. The Zek was 17 at that point. Initially, he was overlooked because he was in prison. He had slept with an older man's wife and then beaten the guy badly when he complained about it. The beaten guy claimed exemption from the draft because of his physical condition, and then he told the recruiter about his assailant in prison. The recruiter was anxious to make his numbers, so the Zek was hauled out of his cell and told to line up with the others in the village square. He did so quite happily. He assumed he was being given a ride to freedom. He assumed there would be 100 opportunities just to walk away. He was wrong. The recruits were locked into a truck, and then a train for a journey that lasted 5 weeks. Formal induction into the Red Army happened along the way. Uniforms were issued, thick woolen garments and a coat, and a pair of felt-lined boots and a paybook, but no actual pay. No weapons, and no training either, beyond a brief stop in a snow-covered rail yard, where a commissar brayed over and over again at the locked train through a huge metal megaphone. The guy repeated a simple 20-word speech, which the Zek remembered ever afterward. The fate of the world is being decided at Stalingrad, where you will fight to the last for the motherland. The 5-week journey ended on the eastern bank of the Volga, where the recruits were unloaded like cattle and forced to run straight for a small assemblage of old river ferries and pleasure cruisers. Half a mile away on the opposite bank was a vision from hell. A city, larger than anything the Zek had ever seen before, was in ruins, belching smoke and fire. The river was burning and exploding with mortar shells. The sky was full of airplanes which lined up and fell into dives, dropping bombs, firing guns. There were corpses everywhere, and body parts, and screaming wounded. The Zek was forced onto a small boat that had a gaily colored striped sunshade. It was crammed tight with soldiers. Nobody had room to move. Nobody had a weapon. The boat lurched out into the freezing current, and airplanes fell on it like flies on shit. The crossing lasted 15 minutes, and at the end of it the Zek was slimy with his neighbor's blood. He was forced off onto a narrow wooden pier and made to line up single file, and then made to run toward the city, past a staging post where the second phase of his military training took place. Two quartermasters were doling out loaded rifles and spare ammunition clips in an endless alternate sequence and chanting what later struck the Zek as a poem, or a song, or a hymn to complete and utter insanity, over and over again without pausing. The one with the rifle shoots, the one without follows him. When the one with the rifle is killed, the one who is following picks up the rifle and shoots. The Zek was handed an ammunition clip. No rifle. He was shoved forward and blindly followed the back of the man ahead. He turned a corner, passed in front of a Red Army machine gun nest. At first, he thought the front line must therefore be very close. But then a commissar with a flag and another huge megaphone roared at him, "No retreat! If you turn back even one step, we will shoot you down!" So the Zek ran helplessly onward and turned another corner and stepped into a hail of German bullets. He stopped, half-turned, and was hit 3 times in the arms and legs. He was bowled over and came to rest lying on the shattered remains of a brick wall, and within minutes was buried under a mounting pile of corpses. He came to 48 hours later in an improvised hospital and made his first acquaintance with Soviet military justice. Harsh, ponderous, ideological, but running strictly in accordance with its own arcane rules. The matter at issue was caused by his having half-turned. Were his wounds inflicted by the motherland's enemy, or had he been retreating toward his own side's guns? Because of the physical ambiguity, he was spared execution and sentenced to a penal battalion instead. Thus began a process of survival that had so far lasted 63 years, a process he intended to continue. He dialed Grigor Linsky's number. "We can assume this soldier is talking. Whatever he knows, they all know now. Therefore, it's time to get ourselves an insurance policy." Franklin said, "We're really no further ahead, are we? No way is Emerson going to accept a damn thing unless we give him more than we got right now." "So work the victim list," Reacher said. "That could take forever. 5 lives, 5 life histories. So let's focus."
"Great. Terrific. Just tell me which one you want me to focus on."
Reacher nodded. Recalled Helen Rodin's description of what she had heard. The first shot, and then a tiny pause, and then the next two, then another pause, a little longer, but really only a split second, and then the last 3. He closed his eyes. In his mind, he pictured Bellantonio's audiograph from the cell phone voicemail. Pictured his own mute simulation in the gloom of the new parking garage, his right arm extended like a rifle. Click, click, click. Click, click, click. "Not the first one," he said. "Not the first cold shot. No guarantee of hitting anything with that. Therefore, the first victim was meaningless. Part of the window dressing. Not the last 3, either. That was bang, bang, bang. The deliberate miss and more window dressing. The job was already done by then."
"So, the second or the third, or both of them?"
Click, click, click. Reacher opened his eyes. "The third. There's a rhythm there. The first cold shot, then a lead-in, and then the money shot, the target. Then a break. His eye is lagging in the scope. He's making sure the target is down." "It is. So then, the last 3.
"Who was the third?" Helen asked.
"The woman," Franklin said.
Linsky called Chenko, and then Vladimir, and then Sokolov. He explained the mission and pulled them all in tighter. Franklin's office had no back entrance. There was just the exposed staircase. The target's car was right there on the apron. Easy. Reacher said, "Tell me about the woman." Franklin shuffled his notes, put them in a new order of priority.
"Her name was Oline Archer. Caucasian female, married, no children. 37 years old, lived west of here in the outer suburbs."
"Employed in the DMV building," Reacher said. "If she was the specific target, Charlie had to know where she was and when she would be coming out." Franklin nodded.
"Employed by the DMV itself. Been there 1.5 years.
"Doing what exactly?"
"Clerical supervisor. Doing whatever they do in there."
"So was it work-related?"
Anyany asked.
"Too long a counter delay?" A bad photo on a driver's license? I doubt it. I checked the national databases. DMV clerks don't get killed by customers. That just doesn't happen.